And I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Mark Sundin. He's a journalist. He's the author of the new book, The Man Who Quit Money. And he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock in the evening here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a book about a very interesting man named Daniel Suelo, who is your friend, who one day in the year 2000 decided to put the last of his life savings, which was about $30, into a phone booth, leave it there, walk away, and has literally not touched money ever since. How did you know him, and how did you come to write this book about him?
I knew him about 17 years ago, before he stopped using money. We were working as cooks in a restaurant in Moab, Utah. And we both, I would say, had gone truant from our career paths. Had been to college. He'd also been in the Peace Corps. And we kind of dropped out and were just not satisfied with getting on the career path, joining the rat race, and trying to achieve wealth and status. But we weren't very close. And in the intervening years, you know, I became a writer, and I bought a house. I became a landlord. I got my IRA. In other words, I became pretty enmeshed in the financial system in ways I never expected to. And meanwhile, as you mentioned, Daniel stopped using money altogether and ended up in a cave. And so after the crash of the economy, when a lot of us started to realize that what we thought was money was something of an illusion, I became fascinated with the choices he had made and saw that, you know, our paths really represented two very different sets of beliefs about money. And so I thought that would be a pretty good starting point for a book.
And I want to get into the wider social implications of what all this means, which you go into in the book. But first, let's talk for a moment about this guy, Daniel, and how he's living now. What are his rules? He has kind of a very clearly thought out, although also continually evolving, set of rules for how he does things. For example, not only does he not work for money, he doesn't even trade and barter. How does he live?
Right. So his philosophy is to take freely what is already up and running, so things that aren't being produced or aren't being made just for him. He wants to receive freely without any obligation of giving back, and he wants to give what he has without any expectation of getting something in return. And so what that means is he doesn't use money, he doesn't barter, he doesn't take any sort of professional charity or government handout. He wouldn't take Medicare. He wouldn't go to a public emergency room. He wouldn't take food stamps. He wouldn't go to any kind of homeless shelter where people were being paid to work there. But he does accept generosity from people who are giving from the heart. And so it starts to become tricky at points because he's realized that he can't be 100% pure because our economic lives are inextricably intertwined. So, for instance, he's not going to stop walking on public roads or sidewalks, even though those were paid with people's involuntary tax dollars. Another thing he does is he uses the public library, and he's taken criticism for this, but this is the one place where he feels he's willing to participate in the public economy, because libraries to him are one of the great things that civilizations produce, and he uses the internet there and whatnot and checks out books.
It's interesting because, I mean, he says he wants to live the way he was raised in a very fundamentalist, very strict Christian household and took Christianity very seriously and wanted to live the way Jesus lives. And it turns out it's almost impossible to do that. Basically, you are forced to live in an economic system, like it or not.
That's right. He told me that although we profess to be a Christian nation, it's illegal to live according to the teachings of Jesus. And specifically what he's talking about is, you know, Jesus' advice to his followers to give away all they have to the poor and come follow him into the desert and, you know, seek a life of spiritual truth rather than material accumulation. And as someone who's lived without a home for the past 12 years, he's constantly finding himself in trouble for being on public lands beyond the allowed 14-day limit, or he's been picked up for hitchhiking and trespassing and riding the rails, some of which are illegal.
His story so reminded me of somebody who's been a longtime hero of mine, whose name is Peace Pilgrim, and whom you mention in the book, and who in the 1950s gave up everything she had, including her name, and had only the clothing on her back and a pencil and a notebook, and decided to walk across the country to bring attention to nuclear weapons and to walk for nuclear disarmament. She walked tens of thousands of miles, and she really did give up everything and took what the land had to offer and took the generosity of others. And Daniel Suelo, about whom you wrote, really is in a tradition. I mean, there are people before him, like her and like others, who were presumably role models for him.
Yeah, he was greatly influenced by Peace Pilgrim. It's funny, actually. Daniel is now 50 years old, and he says that he feels like he is such a wimp in comparison to Peace Pilgrim because he always carries a backpack with him, and he collects sleeping bags and pads and cups and pots and pans out of dumpsters. Whereas Peace Pilgrim didn't begin her walking until she was about 50. And all she carried with her, I believe, was a toothbrush and a notepad.
Right.
And she would just sleep on the side of the road. She said she would walk until someone offered her a place to stay and a meal to eat. And she did that for 30 years.
Yeah, an amazing story. And you can hardly call Daniel a wimp, but you can see what he's you can see what he's saying in comparison. But tell us more about his life. I mean, how does he live? Where does he live? What does he eat? How does he stay warm in cold winters and clean?
So most of the time he lives in caves near Moab, Utah, in the canyon lines. And he's figured out so that he can block the mouth of the cave with a plastic sheet. And he actually has a little wood stove that he built out of old tin bread box and out of cans that he strung together as a chimney. So he can stay warm in there during the winter. And he eats partly from foraging for wild edibles. He even eats roadkill animals if he finds them. But the majority of this food comes from food that other people are throwing away. In America, we throw away 40% of the food that we grow and produce. He finds perfectly edible food in the dumpsters outside of supermarkets. And this isn't just rotting vegetables. This is, you know, food that's still in its package, that's still wrapped in plastic. Maybe it's reached its expiration date. He does quite well in that way. And what I noticed about him, spending about 2 years off and on researching him, was that he never went hungry, and he never seemed the slightest bit worried that he wasn't going to eat the next day.
Well, that's the amazing part. I mean, one would think, not knowing as much about it, you know, once you read the book, you start to really get it more deeply, but you would think that somebody who isn't making plans, doesn't have food in the refrigerator, doesn't have a refrigerator, and is living in such a barren place would be continually on edge about where their next meal was coming from. What is it that, I mean, how do you understand that total lack of anxiety?
You know, for Suelo, it's all about living by faith, and this is something that he learned from the teachings of Jesus and also from the teachings of the Buddha and Lao Tzu and from Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita, this idea that if you live in the moment and you don't worry about what will come tomorrow, then the present will provide for itself. And it's an idea that I think so many people have all longed to experience, but we have so much fear that it won't work out. And this was something that Daniel struggled with for 39 years until he quit money, always asking himself, why can't I live by faith? Why do I think about this and long for it, but lack the courage to do it? And so he finally did it and found, much to his surprise, I guess, and certainly to my surprise, that worrying kind of went away, and he found himself more satisfied and more content without money than he was with money.
Well, there is a little bit of, I mean, that saying, trust in God but tie your camel. I mean, there are people who live by faith and think that they can heal themselves of every kind of disease, or that they can handle poisonous snakes and won't be bit, and they die and they get bit, and faith alone is not really enough.
Well, it's, I think statistically you would find that it isn't enough, but in Suelo's case, he has found it to be that he's not done much planning for the future in the past 11 years, and yet he still seems to get the things he needs.
We're talking to Mark Sundin about the book, The Man Who Quit Money. Now, one thing that is so interesting, and I think a really wonderful example that even for those of us who aren't going to give away everything we have and live in the woods or whatever, one thing that's interesting is he takes what life has to offer. So somebody threw away a pair of binoculars, he found them, and so he took up birding. And there is this kind of receptiveness to what life literally offers him and then really running with it.
Yeah, it's been like that for these 11 years, you know, since he found a guitar, and so he took up playing guitar. Or, like you mentioned, he found the binoculars, so he took up birding. Someone came to visit him who was a master at Qigong, the martial art, so he started to learn that. And that's part of his whole path, is to accept what life offers him. And, you know, I would say that when I first started writing this book, I thought that the message that I was going to arrive at was that we should do with less, that we don't need everything we have. And it turns out that's not the message, and that's not actually what Daniel's life means to him or to me. I think that what his life is, why the book has been inspiring people, is because the message is really to follow your heart. And as it turns out, the thing that he wanted to do, that his heart told him to do, was live this life of faith from the way that he'd read about in religious prophets. And in order to do that, he had to give up everything, including, you know, society's approval. This is a guy that has a degree in anthropology, was in the Peace Corps, worked as a social worker, and he's had to face the stigma of being a homeless person. So most people just assume he's nuts. And after spending 2 years with him, I came away thinking he wasn't nuts, but that he was someone who had really done what he wanted with his life.
He came from, Daniel Suelo came from a fundamentalist Christian household, and very strictly, not only strictly Christian, but kind of anti every other religion.
Right.
And he has a kind of interesting and complex relationship to Christianity, because he moved away from that world, he joined the Peace Corps, he explored other religions. He also came back, but in a different way. Talk about that journey.
Well, one of the main reasons that he fell away from Christianity was because when he was in college, he realized he was gay, and it took him several years to come out. And when he did, he didn't feel like he had a place in the Christian church was no longer open to him or very welcoming. And so he drifted away, and he spent time in a monastery, a Buddhist monastery in Thailand, and he spent some time in India. He was interested in the sadhus, who are the Hindu wandering monks. And when he came back, he decided he was going to try to live like a sadhu, except he was going to try to do it in America, where there's no support or there's no tradition of that. And he still remains very close with his family. And so the more he spent time with them, and they're always debating religion and the Bible. And he felt like he had thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And he felt like that the sort of inspiration and peace that he had got in his teenage years, in his early 20s, from being a Christian, was something he still wanted. And so he went back to the Bible, and, you know, he kind of interprets it according to his own beliefs, and he sees that Jesus' teachings apply to him. You know, he feels like he's really living the way that Jesus told his followers to live. And so in that way, he doesn't have a whole lot of conflict with Jesus. Of course, he doesn't feel still that there's a place for him in organized Christianity, but he doesn't struggle with the faith itself.
How has his family adjusted to, first of all, his being gay, and second, his being a kind of more of a universalist than a strict Christian?
Well, as far as the Christian question, you know, when I went out to meet them, I assumed that they were going to be very sort of judgmental or disappointed in him, because they're quite conservative, and here they have this son who didn't get married, didn't get a job, doesn't live in a house, but lives in a cave and embraces very liberal politics in some ways. But I found it was actually quite the opposite, because they live a life in which the Bible is so real to them, and it's something they sort of live and breathe every day. The idea of going off to the desert to live off of honey and locusts didn't seem that odd to them. You know, that would have seemed a lot more odd to a more secular family that was interested in getting their kids into a good college and getting a good career. So as they've aged, they've really come around to seeing what he's doing and admiring it and thinking that, you know, he's really managed to be free in a way that most of us haven't. As far as the homosexuality, they still struggle with that. You know, they know that he's gay, but they don't really want to talk about it. They don't want to meet his boyfriends, and it's just kind of, they have a detente on that, you might say.
Although there was a kind of lovely moment where, was it his father? Somebody in his family met a man who was gay, and he said, the relative of Daniel said, "I've got a gay son," and the other man
was
able to feel at home. Yeah, it was his father.
At the Christian bookstore,
right,
in Colorado, where they live, and a man came in, and they start talking, and this guy, as they talked, his father talked about having a gay son, and the man in the store said, "You know, I'm a Christian, and I'm gay, and I can't find any fellowship." And after they'd spoken for an hour, he said, "You know, this is the most meaningful Christian fellowship I've had since I moved here." And so it's kind of a powerful moment for both of them.
I think it's so interesting that Daniel Suelo, who when he was young wanted to be a missionary to the heathens, I mean, really loved Christianity and believed in it, now kind of wants to be a missionary to the Christians, as he put it.
He really feels that organized Christianity has lost its way. And specifically, he feels that, you know, that they have taken literally some of the Old Testament stuff about, homosexuality and adultery, and they've taken that very literally, and so they've become sort of hateful and intolerant. And yet when it comes to Jesus' teachings, they tend to view those as parable. They say, "Oh, well, Jesus didn't actually mean give away your money and go into the desert." And I tend to agree with him. And, you know, the other thing, of course, is they've taken quite literally the book of Revelation, which was written after Jesus' death, this idea that the end is near. And that's fine. But again, you know, the church is named after Jesus, and the best record we have of what he actually said during his life, those are the teachings that seem to be most ignored.
You know, I think it's funny, just as an aside, every single generation since the book of Revelation was written thought that it applied to them.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, the book of Revelation speaks about an end of times, of course. And as Daniel would interpret it, Jesus talks about living in the eternal present, living for the moment, not worrying about the future. And in that way, Jesus' teachings start to resemble Eastern philosophy or even American Indian beliefs that time is linear. That time runs in a circle. You know, this is something that you hear in Buddhism or that you hear from Lame Deer. That time works in cycles like the seasons. And of course, in Judeo-Christian ethics, there was a beginning in the garden, and there is an end at the millennium, at the revelation. And, you know, Daniel's personal interpretation of Jesus' teaching is that he was that Christ was talking more about, let's live in the now, in the present, that the kingdom of heaven is here now. And so that really changes the worldview when you start to think that you can find happiness here and now rather than in the afterlife.
We're talking to Mark Sundin about the book, The Man Who Quit Money. Now, how did this whole story, the writing of it, living near Daniel for the years that you were writing this book, how did that all affect you?
Well, you know, one of the premises of the book and one of Daniel's main points is that money is an illusion. And when I first heard that, I thought that was ridiculous, because even if the $20 bill in my pocket is just a piece of paper, I knew that I could go exchange it for food, which is not an illusion, and I could eat that. You know, after the collapse of the economy, people started to think, wow, my house was worth $500,000, and the very next day it was only worth $300,000. What happened to that $200,000? Did it even exist, or was it just an abstraction on paper? Or in other words, is it an illusion? And I guess that's one way I've changed, is coming around to believe that our money system is, in fact, an illusion. I would say, in fact, our money system is a religion. We've come to believe that these so-called laws of the free market are created by God and set in stone, and we can't violate them. And as a result, we do all sorts of irrational things. I mean, you know, we're going to destroy the planet that we live on because we can't stomach the idea that corporations are not allowed to make a profit, or we can't stomach the idea that government is allowed to stop corporations. And that's an idea. So to me, we're putting the make-believe in front of the real. In other words, it's an illusion. And when I started to think like that, I don't know, it's kind of like the crack in the levee, and you start to really question your relationship with money and start to wonder if we as a culture are doing it right.
How does this whole story speak to, I mean, you're talking about how it speaks to these questions about the illusory nature of money and the sort of crazy layers of, I mean, I personally think that if you trade a dollar for a tomato, there's something real to that. But when you have 17 levels of derivatives that are being traded, that somewhere in between those two, it becomes illusory. But how does all this speak to the kinds of movements that are going on all over the United States? People who are maybe not going to the extreme that Daniel is, but still asking some of the same questions.
All across the political spectrum, people are starting to realize that we've created something of a Frankenstein's monster with our financial system. On the right, you have the Tea Party, and they're saying that the Federal Reserve is a cartel. In other words, it's basically a counterfeiting racket, and it's leading us down the road to serfdom. On the left, you have the Occupy movement, who is pointing out that our government is in the chokehold of the financial industry, and we can't even police it because the banks own the government. And then in the middle, you have the climate change movement, who, as I mentioned before, is worried that we're willing to sacrifice the planet we live on in service to these abstract ideas about economic freedom. And, you know, all these groups feel really powerless because they say, how can I be against the Fed when I use money? Or how can I be against Wall Street when I have an IRA account? Or how can I be against big oil when I drive a car? And so I think the reason that they're finding Daniel inspiring isn't because they want to go live in a cave and dumpster dive for their food, but rather that here is someone who has not only imagined a way to live outside of this money system that we've sort of accepted as the only way of living, but he's actually executed, he's actually achieved it. And he said, you know, I can live without money altogether. Imagine what you can do if you wanted to.
There are movements going on that you write about, like the Freegans and others, and there are some interesting and sort of haunting stories as Daniel kind of starts on this path and goes up to find a commune or an intentional community that lives totally without money and finds an abandoned house with it was like a sunken ship with a logbook that had the last entries in it and things like that. There's some crazy, I don't want to say crazy, but there's all sorts of people practicing and thinking about this stuff and really living it.
Yeah, and, you know, this sort of movement that I'll call for an umbrella group, you know, the movement of radical simplicity, it's pretty active, but it tends to get pushed to the margins, to the fringes, when in fact it has a long tradition dating back centuries in America, you know, to Thoreau and Emerson and the Transcendentalists, and to the religious communes and the Shakers and the Quakers and the Amish and the Mennonites, you know, all up through the back to the land movement of the 60s and 70s and the diggers in San Francisco who were interested in, you know, having a free economy, up to the Freegans of today who were dumpster diving and trying to boycott the economy altogether. What interested me about this book, one of the main reasons I wrote it, was I thought that even though Daniel is about as far on the fringe as you can get, you know, his ideas, if you trace their lineage, they're kind of at the core of our civilization. You know, all of the major religious prophets are talking like this. More modern figures like Martin Luther King and Gandhi are talking like this. And the question is, why has this been pushed so far to the margin? And one credible answer is that we have all assumed this sort of worship of money and of the financial industry, that anything that contradicts that is considered heresy, and we won't listen to it. We'll, you know, we shut our ears and label these people fringe lunatics.
I think we're all, or many of us, are frightened of what our, about what our lives would be like if we didn't have any money and didn't have any savings. And in fact, a lot of people who haven't chosen an intentional spiritual path, but rather have lost their jobs and had their houses foreclosed on, are in fact living that, and it's terrifying.
Absolutely. You know, and I don't have a solution. You know, we're all so deep into this now that it's hard to figure out how, you know, once you get into debt and you're without a job and you're without a home, there's no easy way out of that. But I guess, you know, what I took away from my time with Daniel was maybe if you can focus on doing something that you love, doing something that's meaningful to you, the things you think you need will fall away. You know, specifically, I mean, I think a lot of us work 40, 50, 60 hours a week because we need the money. And as a result of all this work, we need more rewards. We need a bigger house to come to. We need a more comfortable car to commute in. We need a better vacation. We need more alcohol and prescription medications to deal with the anxiety. And, you know, what if we could choose a life that was meaningful on its own terms, and not choose a career that paid well? Maybe some of those things we thought we needed would turn out to be superfluous.
One of the things that I got out of the book was that if you kind of go along with Daniel Suelo on his path and kind of feel his need and his ability to live on the land, then you also basically have to understand habitat, wildlife habitat, and that all the creatures running around on the earth are doing exactly the same thing as he's doing, living within their means. There's no money in the wild. They're scavenging, they're eating, they're making their homes with what's available. And when we destroy their homes, it's like destroying the homes of people. And you know, Daniel should be respected and these creatures should be respected. That was kind of my takeaway from, one of my takeaways from this book.
Yeah, he certainly lives in a pretty close harmony with nature. You know, he lives outside, so of course he does. One of the funny things he said, you know, he and I did I drove him around the country for 6 or 7 weeks. We did a book tour when the book first came out in March. And people always ask him, you know, isn't it hard? Isn't it a lot of suffering to be out there? Aren't you, you know, like some kind of ascetic who was not enjoying life as much as you could? And he says, well, sometimes I feel like that, but then I just look at a bird in a tree and I think, is that bird suffering? Is that bird an ascetic? Does that bird feel like he's renounced anything for what he has?
Right.
And so, you know, he thinks that humans really aren't as different as other species than we imagine we are.
The book is called The Man Who Quit Money by Mark Sundin, who will be tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening. We are looking forward to welcoming you to Santa Fe.
Thanks. Yeah, I hope to see people out there. In the meantime, if you check out my website, quitmoney.net, you can learn more about the book. And I hope to see you tonight.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Thank you.